Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashberry. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1234 features three stories by Life Rattle writer Renat Kalhammer. Renat Kalhammer came to Canada in 1957, a year after her husband immigrated from Germany. After a month in Montreal, the couple moved to Kitchener, where they lived for 6 years before settling in what is now Mississauga. Kalhammer raised three children while she worked part-time at a bank and went to university part-time, graduating with her BA in 1999. But it's her life before she came to Canada which formed the basis for the stories we are going to hear on tonight's program. Renat Kalhammer has written a series of stories about growing up in Germany during the Second World War. Kalhammer was born in Stuttgart in 1933, the same year that Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor in Germany. She spent the first 12 years of her life under Hitler's Nazi dictatorship. By the time she was 8 years old, as she writes in one of her stories, she did not know what peace meant and could remember only the hardship and destruction of war. Kalhammer's stories take us behind the front lines and show us in vivid scenes and incidents the deteriorating effects of war on the civilian population of the losing side. So let's listen now as Renat Kalhammer reads her first story. And you're listening to Life Rattle from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And remember, Life Rattle stories sometimes have language and situations that some people find offensive, so listener discretion is advised.
The day a bomb hit our house. By Renate Kalhammer. By the spring of 1942, the German people were taking the war seriously. It was supposed to be a blitzkrieg, a lightning war. Now it had dragged on for 2.5 years. The German government handed out ration cards to make sure that everybody was getting something to eat. We were forbidden to hoard food. The air raids happened more often now. We received orders to pick up gas masks at the community center in case of gas attacks. Gas masks came in different sizes for men, women, and children. Everybody had to try them on. I was 8. I tried one on for children. I could not breathe. The rubber smelled bad and the filter did not let enough air in. I panicked. Mama quickly pulled the thing off my head. A piece of cardboard was stuck in the filter. I hope I'll never have to put that on again, I complained, and took a few deep breaths. I hope not, said Mama. But everybody has to take one home. Our house had 5 apartments. On every level, the tenants had to put up big buckets of sand to smother fires. The landlords posted signs to the nearest water taps. Everybody had to learn how to extinguish fires quickly. Big signs showed up all over with a hackneyed rhyme, Gegen Feuer und Brand hilft nur Wasser und Sand. Only water and sand help against fire. My friends and I used to make up a song to sing while skipping ropes. Feuer und Brand, Wasser und Sand. In school, the teachers warned us never to touch any unexploded incendiary bombs because they contained phosphorus. This stuff could eat our skin away and burn into our flesh. We searched all over for these bombs. They represented a prickly kind of danger. Nobody ever believed that any bombs would fall on Stuttgart, our town. Stuttgart lies in a valley, surrounded by hills on all sides. Often at night, a gentle fog would form over the town. The authorities decided to help this natural camouflage by blowing artificial fog over the city at nights. They hoped that the fog and the total blackout, which was rigorously enforced, would make us invisible to enemy airplanes. They were wrong. The air raids became more frequent, but very few bombs had fallen so far, and the population of Stuttgart felt secure and invincible. Some people who did not want to obey the orders to seek shelter watched the action from rooftops and balconies during the raids. They told us later how the big searchlight crisscrossed the night sky. When they caught an enemy plane in their beams, the flak, Fliegerabwehrkanone, which means anti-aircraft guns, took aim right away. Sometimes they hit their target. In the meantime, the enemy bombers dropped Christmas trees, clusters of firecracker rockets, to illuminate what lay below. "Why can't I go up on the roof and watch?" I whined. "That is much too dangerous for a little girl. Besides, it is forbidden, you know that." "You would be scared anyway," Mama said. She was right, of course. Sometimes a few incendiary bombs found a target. They did not cause big explosions. One just saw buildings suddenly go up in flames. One night, after another air raid, some of the neighbors gathered in front of our house to look at a burning building down in a city. "My, how this burns quickly," said one old man. Another fellow, by chance, turned around and looked up at our house. "Looks like you have a nice fire starting up there, too, on your roof." Quickly, everybody ran upstairs to the attic to see what they could do to save the house. It was too late. The whole roof was aflame. A burn bomb had hit our roof. The roof itself was covered with slate shingles, which did not burn, but the bomb slid down and got caught in the eaves trough. It quickly burned through the wooden soffit. The phosphorus spread and the flames caused a lot of damage. Soon the fire engines came. They pumped oceans of water over the roof of our building. The water came down through the ceiling like a waterfall. We had to mop up water for 2 days. I wore my bathing cap in order not to get my long braids wet. Our family used all available sponges and towels to get rid of the flood. I dumped bucket after bucket of dirty water into the toilet. In the olden days, the attic had contained the bedrooms of the servants. Now, since nobody had servants anymore, we stored off-season clothes up there, in large wardrobes and boxes. All of our winter clothes and all our spare bedding were burned. Many books and photo albums were burned. The firemen threw all the burning stuff down into the yard. The tenants of our building poked through the still-smoking, black-smelling rubble to see if any of their possessions could still be saved. The fire made the news next day. People came from all over town to look at our burned-out attic. I was called up in school to stand in front of the class to tell the children what had happened. I felt excited and happy that I was for once the center of attention. All of us who lost household goods in the air raid had to submit a claim to the government. We got reimbursed for our losses. We did not realize at the time how lucky we were. As the war went on, the air raids came every day and several times every night. Countless bombs fell. Bombs became bigger and noisier and more effective in destruction. One especially nasty type we called air mine. This bomb could level a city block in a few seconds. Most of our cities suffered total destruction. There were no more fire engines available, and the firemen had to fight at the front. There was no more reimbursement for lost household goods. Most of us were lucky to be alive, and those of us whose homes were not totally destroyed took in neighbors who had lost everything. The smell of burning and the dust of broken buildings were always with us. Often we had no water, no gas, no electricity, no way to get around town, no food. People's looks became gaunt and dirty. They searched around furtively for firewood, pieces of coal, or maybe some potatoes. Many freezing neighbors chopped their furniture into kindling to heat their damaged homes and to cook on makeshift stoves. Mama talked longingly about the time before the war. I was 8 and did not know what peace meant. I did not remember anymore when times were not like this.
That was Renate Kalhammer reading her story, The Day a Bomb Hit Our House. Kalhammer's next story is called The Christmas Angel, so let's hear that one now.
The Christmas Angel by Renate Kalhammer. These were the dark times in Germany. December 1944. I was 11. I had lived away from home for a long time. The government had ordered all German school children evacuated from the cities because of the frequent air raids. Now Mama came to Biberach, where I stayed with distant relatives, to get me home for the Christmas holidays in Stuttgart. I was so excited. I could not sleep. I could not eat. This was unusual, since all of us were hungry all the time. Mama arrived late in the evening. She looked pale, sick, dusty and disheveled, ready to drop from exhaustion. What happened, Mama? It was pretty bad. It took me all day to get here. Ulm is burning. We decided to wait till the morning to start the journey home. Mama was much too tired. Mama had no energy to talk anymore about her trip. I hope we'll make it home all right, she whispered. Next morning we took the earliest train north. We usually changed trains in the town of Ulm when we travelled home to Stuttgart. Normally the 30-kilometer distance took less than 1 hour. But because of the constant air attacks on the railways, the train ride took most of the day. Whenever fighter planes came into view, the engineer stopped the train and blew the steam whistle. The passengers then got out and ran for cover. The anti-aircraft gun on the last car blasted away at the attackers. When the planes left, the whistle blew again. 2 short blasts, and the people climbed back on the train, and the journey continued until the next attack. When we got there, there was not much left of Ulm. Most of the town was destroyed. People dug in the rubble of what used to be their homes. But now it was dark, except for the burning buildings, which colored the sky orange. We coughed from the acrid stench of the fires. Every one of the railroad bridges across the River Danube was destroyed by bombs. Our train came to a stop at a blown-up bridge. The passengers got out and walked along the railway bed towards the river. The coarse stones on the embankment made walking hard. The older people stumbled. Some lost their luggage in the dark. At the river, some rowboats ferried people across the Danube. We had to wait a long time for our turn. Many of the passengers shouted, shoved, and argued. At the other side of the river, we had to climb up another steep embankment. We looked for our train. Locomotives and railway cars stood all over the place. The damaged ones needed uncoupling and were pulled aside. The railroad workers inspected the tracks for missing sections. Nobody knew where to go in the dark. Burning buildings offered the only light. A stout farm woman with a large pillowcase full of parcels and a bag walked beside us. She wore a thick beige coat, about 2 sizes too small for her, and a colorful kerchief on her head. We said hello. "Where are you two gypsies going?" she grinned. "We are looking for the train to Stuttgart," I said. "Well, ain't that funny? So am I. We'll have to find somebody who knows his way around this mess." She shouted at a trainman, "Hey, which way is the train to Stuttgart?" Her booming voice carried through the clamor. A railway policeman pointed us in the right direction. Mama was glad that we had found somebody who could take charge. She was too exhausted herself. It seemed like hours until we found what was left of the Stuttgart train. The cars were already packed tight with people. We had to push our way in. Around midnight, the train started to move slowly northward. The windows on the railway cars all painted black. Tiny squares left in the middle allowed us to look out and see where we were. There was not a lot of lighting at the stations, so it was hard to read the names of the towns. No light was permitted in the cars because of the blackout. The authorities were afraid that enemy airplanes could see the lights of the trains and start attacking them again.
"Why bother? I think the Allies have found these trains already, blackout or not," said the woman. Everybody laughed.
She wanted to know all about me. I felt comfortable talking to her. I sat down beside her. Mama sat on her suitcase in the aisle and tried to sleep. People were taking turns to share the seats. Sometimes in the early morning, we neared Stuttgart. The woman asked me, "What have you got in your rucksack there?" I opened it up and showed her my sweater and socks.
"Good. You have room in there for this."
She took a whole chicken out of that huge pillowcase of hers and put it in my rucksack. "You look all starved, you poor little thing. Merry Christmas," and she got quickly off the train. Mama still dozed in the aisle. I sat stunned. I pushed my way over to Mama and shook her awake. "Mama, look what the lady gave me." Mama rubbed her eyes. "Where is she? Did you say thank you?" Chicken meant unimaginable riches to us. Our ration cards allowed everyone only to buy one loaf of bread a week, 100 grams of margarine, 1 liter of skim milk for children under 12, and some potatoes. We had seen no meat for a long time. When we reached home, our exhaustion had disappeared. "Look what we brought for Christmas." Oma and Tante Grete were very happy. This chicken would feed Oma, Tante Grete, Mama and me for at least a week. The huge white hen still had all its feathers, the head and the feet. To us, it was a special gift from the Christkind. The Christkind used to come unseen to German children on Christmas Eve and put the presents under the tree. This year we had no Christmas tree. The few trees brought into the city were only for families with children under 10 years old. I was 11. We had no lights, no candles, no presents, only a chicken. We never celebrated another Christmas together anymore. Both Oma and Tante Grete died soon after the war ended.
That was Renate Kellhammer reading her story, The Christmas Angel. Kellhammer's final story on tonight's program is called The Last Days.
The Last Days by Renate Kellhammer. The weather was beautiful in the spring of 1945 in South Germany. For days, the bedraggled leftovers of the beaten German army trekked through the town of Nürtingen. The men had lost most of their gear, their weapons, their uniforms. They seemed dirty and untidy and listless. We stood by the road and handed them water and bread. Bread we couldn't really spare. "The army is right behind us," the soldiers said. The advancing American army finally closed in. We heard artillery barrages all day and night. Fighter planes attacked the fleeing columns and the area around them relentlessly. A group of German soldiers hid a tank in a neighbor's barn. They covered it with straw and hay. The neighbor shouted, "What are they going to do to me if they find your tank?" But the soldiers had already fled. The next 2 days were eerily quiet. No more artillery fire, no more plane attacks, no more German soldiers came through. This frightened us more than the sounds of the battle before. We now sat between the two armies in a no-man's land. At dusk on the third day, We heard rumbling, like heavy machinery on the move. We had not seen or heard any fighter planes for a while. I ran outside and called my friends. We wanted to see what was going on. I did not tell Mama that I was going out or where I was going. Huge army trucks drove slowly down the road. Armored personnel carriers and tanks rumbled behind. On each side, strange-looking soldiers walked with rifles ready and scanned the buildings left and right. The vehicles looked different from the German tanks and trucks. I could not see who drove the trucks. As they came closer, I saw eyes and white teeth. I had never seen a live black person before. The soldiers stopped and prepared food and bivouacs for the night. They tried to shoo away the crowd of children, but we had smelled food. We were not so easily discouraged, but they gave us nothing. "Hey, Renate, you know English. Why don't you talk to them?" I was too scared to talk. Besides, what little English I had learned, I could not remember. When night fell, we all went home. Mama was beside herself with fear and worry about me. "Where on earth have you been? I thought they might have taken you prisoner or killed you. How could you do this to me?" she cried. "I really thought you were dead. I was sure I was not going to see you anymore." I did not say much. I felt bad. During the next few days, a military government was established for the region. Everybody who had belonged to the NSDAP, Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, had to report to City Hall. They kept the men. There were only very old men left anyway. All the young and middle-aged men had gone to war. The Americans set a curfew. Nobody could go outside after 8 p.m. But now at least we didn't have to suffer any more air raids and no more fighter plane attacks. I was very happy that we could finally sleep through the nights. The grown-ups walked around with worried faces. After all, the German authorities had warned us how horrible the enemy was. What are they going to do to us? The main problem was how to get food. At the railroad station, some people found a freight car with oats and sugar. The news spread quickly. Every family received a small bag of sugar and a large bag of oats. These supplies we shared scrupulously. Nobody took more than their share. The American soldiers looked so healthy and well-fed. They acted friendly to the children, but they were not allowed to fraternize with Germans. After a few more weeks, Germany declared a Waffenstillstand, literally the stillness of arms. We did not call it VE Day. For us, the war was over. We were at ground zero. We children found all this exciting. There was no school and not much parental supervision. The rules did not apply anymore. We roamed the town like wild things. We played on the rubble of the demolished bridges in the river. Unexploded bombs fascinated us. Undetonated incendiary bombs contain a substance like gasoline. We used this to clean bicycles. A few of us got hurt, but this did not stop us. We had seen many people with lost limbs and terrible wounds. When anybody found something edible, we shared it. Once we found some wrinkled apples from the previous fall in a cellar of a bombed-out house, and another time an old turnip in a barn. We also shared jackets and shoes. It took a long time till some normalcy came back into our lives. The schools had been closed for almost a year. When the schools opened again in the fall of 1945, we were cynical and old for our years. I think we were not easy to teach.
We were fooled once. Nobody was going to fool us anymore. Grown-ups, especially teachers, could not be trusted. Weren't they the ones who had told us to believe in a Führer and the Endsieg, the final victory? There were no history books and no geography books available because everything had to be cleansed from Nazi propaganda. We just laughed. Some of the books had blacked out paragraphs and pages glued together. We held the pages against the light and pried the glued paper apart so we could read the forbidden text. Our parents were even more confused than we were. It took a long time for us to learn how to live normal lives again.
That was The Last Days, written and read by Renate Kellhammer. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1234. Arnie Ackman recorded Renate Kellhammer reading her stories. My name is Virginia Ashbery. Life Rattle returns next week with more stories. And Life Rattle is produced from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.